To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction. You're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast in no direction. My name is Don Moore, and sitting across from me is a man that's unencumbered by the pull of gravity. And that is only Mr.
Al. Wow, that's incredible. I'm gravity has no effect on me.
His imagination and the way he lives his life is just second to none.
That's right. Second to none.
Us lesser humans, gravity affects us.
Sure.
We get caught up in day-to-day things. But
never me. I could give a rat's butt. But anyway. So what are we here to do? We're here to talk about comic books, or are we here to talk about music, or
no, let's talk
what
about
direction are we going to take today?
I was going to ask you, has there ever been a time where there was an artist that you, as soon as you saw their work, you hated? I mean, just absolutely
yeah,
hated.
Probably.
And then within a couple of months, you turned around and thought he was the greatest in the world.
Within a couple of months? No, maybe like about 10 years or 20 years.
You know, we've talked about that on one of the earliest, it was one of my favorite episodes. I think it was episode 4. We talked about artists we didn't like as kids that we grew to like.
Yeah, which is most of them for me now.
Yeah, well, yeah. And that's, you know, you can grow to appreciate things you didn't see as a kid. But there is one artist that
whose work you hated, and 2 months later you liked it. If this is like in the past this happened, or was
no,
this happened
I was,
recently?
I was in high school. You remember the magazine Epic Illustrated?
Sure, yeah.
Epic Illustrated, Marvel Comics put it out. It was Archie Goodwin's child. And it's basically, it was heavy metal.
Yeah.
It was different, but it was like heavy metal. It was a big magazine full of illustrated stories, and it was the same vein. And there was a story called Jack Tales that came out, and I was so offended that that was in the book. I looked at it. It was black and white, had gray washes or gray tones. And I just thought, I hate this guy. And I did read the story, as always, but I was so offended it was in the book. You know, I thought it was out of place. And it was by Charles Vess.
Really? You didn't like him, huh?
Jack tells that Jack was a thief. I mean, he had these three circular robots with arms that floated around him. And,
this stuff isn't his super prime work. I mean, you know, I'm just looking at it. It looks like it's early work.
Oh, what I was talking about, thanks to Scott Connor, I found a book called Charles Vess, The Book of Night, Book of Night, that Dark Horse put out. The reason being was, and this does have the two Jack Tales stories in it, although the first Jack Tales stories, I think it's missing a couple of pages. But Jack Tales, the first issue, or the first story, I didn't care for much. Well, then a later issue, a couple of months later, they put out Children of the Stars. And I was so pissed that, you know, man, they put this guy in again. I hate this guy. And I started reading the story, and I really liked it. And there was a couple of scenes in that story that just stayed with me to this day. Basically, it's about a brother and sister. They're raised by a witch.
Yeah, that's the first story, isn't it? The second story?
Yeah, I think it's the first story. But they're raised by a witch that has a small troll servant. And they end up fighting something. The brother, it looks like he's killed, but I guess he's on death's door. Anyway, the witch tells the sister that she has to go to the Ancient Ones and ask for help. Basically, the whole story goes on, but at one point they send her through this portal, and she goes in this beach, and she has to find the Dark Lord's soul. And it's a beach full of pebbles. And the one, it's a page that just blows my mind, where she's, you know, all she sees is pebbles as far as the eye can see. And she's just thinking, how am I going to find this? I'm kind of butchering the story. Her parents, it tells the story how they were killed. Something about they were children of the stars, and somebody was grasping power, which is one of these guys. Anyway, she sees she says, one tiny pebble among so many. How am I to find the soul stone of the Dark Lord? She sees an old woman, you know, hunched over, digging through these pebbles. And she goes, who are you? He goes, hey, have you come to help me? I grow old. My eyes can no longer see the tiny pebbles as they once did. No, old woman. The old ones sent me here too. The old ones, yes. They brought me here too. Bright were their promises. Your husband has died in our service. Find his soul and he will be returned to you. Yet now I am old and he will be returned. He will be as young as he was, young and strong. Look at me. Will he even recognize this face? But I must find him. Help me, please. And then she explains that she can't, you know, she's got a task also. She has to find the Lord Nezenthor, Prince of Demons. Because, oh, that one, black as it is evil, is that stone. It fills the air with its cold breath. Years ago I passed it down the beach. That way you will not miss it. Now leave me. You waste my time. I grow older with each breath I take. Go. I never forgot that page. I just thought that was amazing. You know, this woman's trying to find her husband, and now she's, you know, she's basically 80, 90 years old. I love that kind of stuff. Anyway, she does find the stone, and it's like six times the size of the other pebble, and it's black. And she goes, a chill wind rattles the stones. I must be close. It is as she said, the very air reeks with evil. So she takes the stone. She finds the Dark Lord. They laugh at her, thinking there's nothing she's doing, and she crushes the stone, and they all die. And then her brother comes back, and it's all nice. Anyway, so that's when I turned from hating Charles Vest to basically, if I see anything he's done, I snag it.
Wow, okay.
And I don't know.
And it's because you actually read the story and you really liked it?
Yeah, but I read Jack Tales, the first story, and I didn't care for it.
Huh. I don't remember his work in Epic.
Well, these stories were in Epic. Well, the first couple.
Well, then you probably had the same effect on me. I saw it, and I was like overwhelmed by some of the other work in there, and not really paying attention. But then toward the end of this book, you can see that his work gets a lot better.
Well, looking at it though, even the early work, it was neat.
Fine. It was neat work. Yeah, it was neat work.
He's got a. One, I never really tested. His lettering is really, really strong. His display lettering and also the, you know, the word balloons.
It's definitely fantasy art, you know, which to me sometimes is hit and miss, you know what I mean? And sometimes I like it and sometimes I can just kind of like, you know, like I like it when Kaluta does it and some people like that, but some folks, but he does it. I mean, that cover is beautiful by Vess.
He always reminded me of old fantasy storybooks. You know, he has like a German kind of look to it. You know, the old German woodcuts and stuff.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's definitely a Kaluta influence.
Yeah, well, I think him and Kaluta are good friends.
Yeah, they had a studio together.
But, oh, that makes sense. He also, on some of a couple of these stories, Elaine Lee, who wrote Starstruck with Michael Kaluta, she wrote a couple of stories here. You know, I don't think you'd have a Hellboy the way it is if it wasn't for Charles Vess's old work.
Oh, maybe, yeah. You know, yeah, definitely.
Those Hellboy stories remind me of a contemporary version of what he did. But I was talking to Scott Connor because I always wished I'd had a collection of the Children of the Night Star or Children of the Stars. And he mentioned the Book of Night, looked it up, and it was in there. Oh, well, there you go.
Oh, well, there you go.
So I picked it up. Here's another one. Children of the Night. I always was Children of the Night. It's Children of the Stars. It was serialized in Heavy Metal. You know, if you read this, I'm kind of surprised at how short the story is. Because in Epic Illustrated, it seemed like that story ran on for 10,000 years. You know, it'd have like 4 to 6 pages an issue. And it's really not long. I thought it'd be long enough to make a really nice graphic novel out of it. No. And I remember, what was it, Jim Starlin, when Epic first started,
Dreadstar?
Yeah, Dreadstar. It used to be called Metamorphos Odyssey.
Yeah, yeah.
And that thing, it seemed like it lasted 10 years. I'm saying that. I loved it. I could not wait to read it. I love Jim Starlin. I like that. But I just looked at it. It was a massive body of work. And you and I talked about it in a past episode, an older, earlier episode. And I was thinking that thing would probably fill up an encyclopedia worth of collections. And kind of find out some publisher I had never heard of put it out. And it wasn't that thick. So I don't know. I guess when you serialize a story in Heavy Metal or Epic Illustrated,
it feels longer.
Yeah, it feels longer because it kind of interrupts the flow.
It's over so many issues and stuff like that, yeah.
But Charles Vess, he had in the 80s, I think Eclipse put out a book called Horns of Elfland, which was a bunch of his stories. Marvel Comics put out a graphic novel of The Raven Banner, which is supposed to be the tale of Asgard, which is beautiful.
Did he do the Books of Magic? I mean, maybe it wasn't him. But
I think he might have been involved. I never bought those.
Yeah, I think he might have some involvement in it. I remember those books. I think I saw his artwork in them, but I'm not 100% sure. But I think he was in some of that stuff. Yeah, he was big time into all that, you know, elves and, you know, hobbit-looking guys or whatever. Yeah, I really like his work a lot. Yeah, you know, but I don't remember seeing him in Epic. I remember seeing, like, other artists, but there were a few artists in Epic Illustrated that I never read their stories. You know, I kept just going for the ones that I really like. And I mean, I'll tell you one in particular, but I still like his art. Was that one in Epic where it was a guy who basically his skin was turned upside down?
Oh, you're talking about Abraxas the Earthman.
Abraxas, yeah. I was never like, I was never a big fan of that.
That was Rick Veitch.
I like his art, though, but I was never a big fan of that concept.
I think that was Rick Veitch and I'm guessing it was John Todleman or Stephen Bissett, maybe.
Yeah, I never read that.
What Al was talking about, there was a series of, it was an Epic Illustrated called Abraxas the Earthman, and it seemed like that went on forever. And those two guys, they did another story about sea monkey creatures in the water, but they were actually looked like small spider monkeys that swam, that kind of like half mermaids. And then they had these, I guess they were like fish submarines. And inside were, you know, like redneck outdoorsmen. You know, they're all drinking beer and yelling at each other. And they were in these submarines chasing these sea monkey things down there, which were giant. They were as big as the subs. And, you know, in Epic Illustrated, at the beginning, it had an introduction of each story and who did it. And I think it was Rick Veitch and Steve Bissett. I know it was Rick Veitch.
Yeah, those guys are connected.
Well, they came from the Cooper School.
Yeah.
And right, that was back when, I guess that was kind of the first graduating class from the Cooper School.
Tom Yates, I'm sure, came from that.
Yeah, he came from that. He was one of the first classes, too. And I was reading Tom Yates was in a kind of comics interview back in the early 80s. And he was just talking about the Cooper School, that basically it was Joe Kubert and a bunch of young guys, and they're all drawing. And he had assignments and stuff. But he said, I think it was...
They worked on that ad book, too. Remember there was an ad book, the comic book, can't think of the name of it right now. It was an ad book that Marvel or somebody had, and it was all drawn, looked like Joe Kubert. They worked on that ad book.
Yeah, they put ads in the comic books that they did.
Yeah. There was a book where, I forgot what it was called, but it was like the catalog, art ad catalog or whatever, it was all by the Kubert School. And it was that school was a way, if you went through it, to get into the business, you know? I mean...
Yeah, well, Jan DeSima came from it. But Tom Yates was talking about...
The Cooper brothers, obviously, came out of it.
But Tom Yates was talking about, I think it was Rick Veitch or Steve Bissett. Cooper liked him because he'd have an assignment of, you know, drawing a story out. And he told you what to put, and I guess these guys had trouble drawing certain things that he was wanting, so they changed the story into bugs. It's the same story, but they put bugs and little creatures like it. And he said Joe Kubert loved it, and he said a lot of times he'd walk through the school late at night, and it'd be Veitch and Bissett and Joe Kubert and these guys all sitting in a corner drawing bugs and monsters. I don't know, I think it's kind of amazing that Joe Kubert had that kind of energy. But, no, Brax is the Earthman, that was another one. I'm like, oh, come on. And it ran forever. But it was kind of interesting because they had things I'd never seen before. Like, the guy, Abraxas, they call him, he ended up, he lost his skin. And this pirate had him. And the pirate kind of had a baboon's face nose on it. He was so alien and horrifying looking. And, you know, he had the blue and red colors on it. And Abraxas was a skinless human. You could see his eyeball sticking out. You could see all the bone and sinew. And, you know, it looked like medical drawings.
Pretty much, yeah.
And at one point, he was, there was an old man that was with him, an earth man, I think. And there was also a woman that I think was kind of like a, she kind of had a human face, but a cheetah's body. And it was a female, but she could talk, and she was a friend of them. And they were all part of this crew, I guess. And there was some doctor that would, I guess he was the one that took Abraxas' skin. And the deal was, if Abraxas helped him, I can't remember why he was there, but he could get his skin back. And at one point, Abraxas found the skin, and it's a whole, basically a human body skin with a face. And it was just empty skin with blonde hair on top. And then he had the two arms tied together over shoulder like a sweater, you know. And there was at one point, there was this creature that looked like a Smoo from Little Abner and two females. And he was on a spacecraft out in space working on something, complaining about the two women, female characters, which were, they were always snuggling each other and arguing that he wasn't there with them. But what was funny was the females, they looked like Smoos, but they had the eyes and the mouth, and where their nose was, they had like 10 to 15 holes between their eyes and their nose, you know, mouth where their nose would be. Well, the male character was the same, except instead of holes, they were protruding feelers. So their sexual organs were right there on their face.
Oh, okay. Oh.
And, And it looked kind of like a mustache, like a Swedish mustache or something.
Yeah, that was a strange strip. It was like, you know, what can I tell you? Like, I like the guy's art. That was just a little too much for me.
Yeah,
it was kind of like an underground comic book.
Yeah, you know? It was, and it got really weird because they started cutting bodies apart and putting them back, like that old man and that cheetah woman. He ended up, his head was on her body, which looked horrendous, and he got mad. And I think he killed the captain or he killed the surgeon or whatever that he did that to that beautiful spirit. And, it's like they weren't afraid to go somewhere, and they went there. And, yeah, it was like an underground comic.
Kind of, yeah. Feature's work always seemed to me like underground comics.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it was good. I mean, because there are good underground comics.
I bought a lot of stuff he did. And, but
wasn't there one called the Brat Pack or something like that? That was one of those epic books or something.
I remember he had an epic book called The One. It was
The One, yeah, right.
And then there was he had a Marvel graphic novel called I think Sunburst.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they were neat concepts. I mean, he had all kinds of different characters. He always had a sideways idea that he pursued, and it was unlike anybody else. And but, you know, it's funny. He was another one. I hated him when I first saw Abraxas the Earthman. As the series went on, one, I was praying it would be over because it went on forever. But I started reading it, especially when, you know, some things started unfolding, and I started reading it, and I'm thinking, why didn't they ever publish this in the graphic novels? People would have liked it. But, yeah, he had a repulsiveness to everything, too. He did another series, I think it was for Epic. This is like at the end of the 80s or early 90s. And I can't remember what it was called, but he had an advertisement. It was a kid getting, you know, superhero action figures off of a rack, like at a store. And I guess it was about superheroes, and it had Dr. So-and-so, and it said Acid Tongue. And he looked like some kind of vile creature, and he had this long serpent's tongue that was really thick. And I always thought that was funny, Acid Tongue, you know, because, you know, that's the double meaning there.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And all these kids, hey, look what I found! And it was horrifying, like an alien creature or something.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of an artist, but if there was an artist whose work I didn't like at first, it would take me a long time, I think, before I got to, like, go, oh, yeah, I like this. But I can't think of anybody that 2 months later I started liking their work, unless, I'm trying to think, I'm trying to jog my brain, if I saw somebody's work, maybe it was early work that it was posted, and then maybe a few months later, they had gotten a lot better and they had a second story print. I'm trying to think if there was something, if there was. I mean, I know of a lot of artists that I've seen their first work, it was like terrible, and then all of a sudden, like a year later, they're excellent. But I can't think of anybody right now. I can think of one guy, and I'm not gonna say his name because I don't want, whose work I didn't like at first. Then I started getting to like it. And then now I look back and I don't like it that much. But I'm not going to say his name, but, you know, but whatever. Well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it happens. Everybody goes through that. I guess the funny thing is with Charles Vest is that, like I said, that first, when Jack Tales came out, I was just hating it. And then when Children of the Stars came out, he became a favorite. We went to Wilson's. I was pulling out all these old Marvel fanfares because he did some of those Tales of Asgard. I think he did 3 or 4 stories. Mm-hmm. And I got mad because Dallas kept showing me something I wanted there, but I wanted to buy the Charles Vest books. Anytime I see Charles Vest, he's one of those character guys I just grab. And
you know, my memory's jogging a little bit. I don't think it happened with Wrightson, but I keep thinking that I saw originally some really early work. But I don't think so. I think it's the opposite. I saw Swamp Thing, and then I went back and I saw the other way. I go, wow, I don't like this. But then, you know, I saw what he was going to turn into. So I think it was kind of like, I think that's happened to me in the opposite, where I come and see the artist's work, and they look, oh, this is really good. And then I start grabbing anything with their name on, and I see real early stuff, and I go, wow, that's kind of, you know. But I know it's going to get better, so I can accept it. But, you know, I think the opposite's happened to me with all the fanzine guys. You know, when they first start out, their work's kind of rough. But then you don't really see it unless you're really like, because I didn't really get into the fanzine stuff until in the later 70s, so I was just buying stuff off the stands. And then when I see the early work, I was like, well, that's not bad, or wow, that's not good, but wow, they really did get a lot better. So I think it happened in the reverse for me in some cases.
You know, it's funny. When you say that, it makes me think a friend of mine at work, Melody, she loved Greg Land. Remember that artist?
Yeah, he was
at the Yancey convention. And, I mean, she just adored him. She always bought his work, always talked about him. And I'd bought a couple of comic books off eBay. And some of those comic sellers, when you buy a couple of books, they throw like 3 others in, you know, just, you know, which I thought was nice. And they were never ever books I was ever interested in. They were like, you know, new defunct publishers. But I'd bring them in to see if she wanted them. And then she just, oh, Greg Land, I love him to death, but I just can't believe how he started out. And they were old stories that Greg Land had done for, you know, small publishers. I guess when he's first starting out, boy, leaps and bounds.
Yeah, I know.
That old work was, I mean, there was a bunch of them like that. First Comics used to have a lot of cartoonists that do backup stories and Nexus and stuff. That, mm-hmm. I mean, I say that, it was work, I never got to do that kind of work, but you look at what these guys started producing just a few years later, night and day, you know, I mean,
yeah, something happened.
Well, Baptism by Fire. It's a lot of work. It's making comics is labor intensive.
Sure, yeah.
And Howard Chaykin always brings up, you saw me grow up in public. I'll be honest, I've never seen anything Howard Chaykin did in the early days that I didn't like. I mean, I understand that, you know, he got a different style and stuff. But I don't agree with him. I think he was good from the start. He just got better and was able to morph.
Well, I mean, with Kirby, I remember seeing Kirby, like in the Fantastic Four, and oh, this is great. But then when I was getting Fantasy Masterpieces that had a nice Kirby cover, I would see the Golden Age Kirby, and I was like, oh, this isn't what happened. You know, it's the early work, and you know, I mean, it's still great, but it was inked by a different guy. It was a little sketchier, maybe, and a little rougher. You know, maybe the reproduction wasn't that great. Same with Bill Everett. Boy, I never liked his work back then, but. Wasn't until I started getting reprints of, like, the books in the 50s that was like, oh, my God. Same thing with Matt Baker. I saw some of his earlier work. I go, it's okay, but, oh, my God, like, in the 50s, it's like his work was, like, freaking one of the greatest.
I'll tell you, and that's an understatement. You know, Matt Baker was somebody I didn't really know much of except because of you.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I absolutely love him. I mean, he's fantastic.
He died at 39.
You know, it's, I'm sorry, but I'll tell you, you left some great work.
Yeah.
And I've never bought any of it. I mean, I'd find some in reprints and stuff.
I've bought a few things, yeah.
But I will buy when I see them now.
No, because it was like, you see the stuff like Phantom Lady, and it looks nice, but it looks like, oh, yeah, this is 40s work, you know.
Yeah, whatever. Exactly.
But, man, in the 50s, I saw some romance books that he did. It was, like, heavily illustrated, and everybody had, like, was really well rendered, and people had all these expressions even in the background. I go, wow, this guy really, like, leaps and bounds. You know, I'm assuming that what happens is that after a certain point, they start using maybe more references, they get into a studio, they learn tricks, they learn how to use people for posing and stuff like that, so their work's going to get better. I know that happened with Jeff Jones. because I read an interview with Louise Jones, and she said that his work just went leaps and bounds when he started using photography. And then I've seen, I don't know where they are, but some fanzines with images where he would get like Kaluta, Wrights, and all these guys and actually pose them for some of the pics for, you know, the problem solving within the story. Like if he needed a face, he could probably do it. But if it was a crowd scene or whatever, he'd just get his friends, and then you see the work, like, wow, this is a lot better, you know what I mean? It was because they started actually, like, they became more sophisticated in their use of,
yeah.
They could still draw, but instead of just trying to come up with something out of your brain, they would actually use references. Whereas people like Kubert and Kirby, they just, everything came out of their brain. I don't know how much reference they use, maybe for backgrounds or something.
I guess the thing is, I've seen some artists that really specialize in expressions, and they're good, but sometimes their body work, you know, the figure drawing is kind of off. You know, Matt Baker, he had all that, but he had a style. His drawings were solid. The figure work was solid. He had the skill set, and he just refined it and made it better. And he was also able to, you know, some of the comics, just how he drew the women's hair, you know, how he drew how everybody was set up, all the scenes were set up, and it made you want to be in those places. You know, Reed Crandall was another one. I remember you were talking about Reed Crandall and everybody wanted him on their book and stuff, and I'm like, yeah, I knew Reed Crandall. I've seen his work. He's good, but and since then, I started noticing that, man, he was second to none. He was
a great illustrator in comic books. Same with Fredette and people like that. They were like illustrators that worked in comics because they liked the medium and they got steady work out of it. They would do other things, as we've talked about before. They would do like comic book work, maybe a book cover or maybe some kind of illustrations for a magazine or whatever. They were just running around. I don't know where. He didn't live in New York, but the guys that lived in New York, they were just walking around looking for work wherever they can get it. You know, all those guys, they came from different backgrounds and fields, so they would like come into comics, and you know, some guys would come into comics and use it as a stepping stone to bigger and better things. You know what I mean? Like advertising, or even like Kinsler, Everett Raymond Kinsler. He started in comics, and then he's a famous painter now. He paints portraits of presidents now. I don't know if they hang in the White House, but they might. They hang in or the famous politicians and famous people commissioned him to do portraits of them. So he became like, you know, like super big artist or whatever. Started out in comic books. But if you look at his comic book work in the 50s, you're already telling, man, this guy's got like the Charles Dana Gibson line work, you know what I mean? This guy might be a little too sophisticated for these books, but it was beautiful, you know. So, yeah, there's a lot of guys like that. But Charles Vest is definitely a guy who his work looks like it should be. I mean, the comic book is great, but it's like book illustrations, you know what I mean? That's what it reminds me of, like Arthur Rackham or people like that.
Yes, exactly. You remind me of old that guy, I can't remember his name all of a sudden, but the one I brought in, he did all the fairy tales.
It was either Rackham or what? Not Beardsley. Not Mucho.
Well, we talked about Beardsley because you said he reminded me of Audrey Beardsley. But I had the one drawing you said looked like Elric.
Oh, you brought that guy. I can't remember what his name was.
Yeah, I can't think of his name all of a sudden. But we did. I bought a big book of his. But anyway, Charles Vest looks like his cousin. You know what I mean?
Basically, yeah.
Charles Vest has a style all of his own. As soon as you see him, you recognize it. He's got this flowing, beautiful style. But it also has kind of a German-Norwegian woodcut look to it.
So you got that from Amazon or something?
Yeah, I bought it online.
Wow, that's kind of cool that you figured out that was in that book. I've never seen that book before.
Well, basically, I was whining, and you know, through messages, and Scott mentioned, he said, you know, there's a Book of Night. Yeah, I remember Book of Night, but it says, I've never seen Children of the Night Stars. And then I thought, as soon as I said that, I looked up on Google like I should have done before I whined. And sure enough, it was there. And then I told Scott, I said, well, thanks a lot. You know, I found it, I just ordered it, you know. He said, oh, well, I'm glad I helped. He said, I stepped away for a while and came back, and I saw this long conversation I typed up. But, Charles Vest, he's second to none. He also did Jeff Smith, who did Bone. He did an off series called Rose, which was Grandma Ben. And Charles Vest illustrated those quite nicely. And then I think Neil Gaiman did Stardust. And it was four prestige format book and comic books, but then they put it on a trade, which I got a couple of the single issues, and I got the trade. But it was more like an illustrated novel, but just absolutely beautiful. And it was in color and beautiful. That's one thing, Charles Vest, he can work in black and white beautifully, and when he puts color in, it's just fantastic. But
well, I cover.
But yeah, exactly. But his color work, it's not like he just took the black line work and filled it in with color like I would do. It's like the lines are colored. It's like
it's
rendered.
It's molded in or blended in or whatever. It's not like a colored drawing or whatever. It's a painting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice work. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, anyway.
We put that a Dark Horse?
Yeah, Dark Horse.
Oh, okay.
I guess they collected a lot of... He mentions Archie Goodwin and Joe Duffy, and thanked them for their guidance.
Yeah, those are the guys behind Epic.
So, Charles Vest, I love you, and I'm sorry that I hated you for about 2 months when I was 17 years
that's
old.
That's too bad, but that's just the way it goes. What's next?
Well, what do you got? You got some stuff here.
All right, well, let's talk about... We mentioned Chaykin before. Let's talk about Chaykin. I was going through my books, pulling stuff, boxing stuff, and then, like, just rearranging things, and I found two books. One of them is this from 89, Wolverine and Nick Fury, The Scorpio Connection.
Yeah.
It's a hardcover Marvel graphic novel. I picked it up back then. It's not a bad book. It's actually a good story. It's like, Nick Fury and Wolverine and Scorpio, which I guess the character from the 60s, I guess he died, and he's supposed to have, according to this book, he was Nick Fury's brother.
Oh, okay.
But then he comes back, and it turns out that he's like Nick Fury's nephew. So there's all this stuff going around, the X-Men make an appearance or whatever. But as I'm reading this book, this is probably... As much as I like Chaykin, this is probably when he's worked for me anyway. I mean, just judging by this book, because I'm not judging it by anything else, this is when his work kind of became, I don't know, when was American Flag? Was American Flag before 89?
Oh, yeah, American Flag was 83.
It was 83, okay. To me, it's like this work, his graphic, because you mentioned, I don't know if you mentioned it on the show, or it was in person or whatever, that Chaykin said that, comic book work is a graphic design, and it's really more of a craft than
art. Well, he said graphic design is a service of narrative.
Yeah, and this book, I think his earlier work was more illustrative. This book is basically graphic design in the service of narrative, because this is strong graphic design, almost too strong graphic design. And some of the... especially some of the Wolverine drawings or whatever are just kind of like sketched in, and they're a little off. Like some panels like this where Wolverine kind of looks awkward or whatever. He was more into like the overall look of the page and the panel or whatever, but it's still beautiful work, what I mean? But, it's kind of like, there was another book that I found too, and I'm not sure if they came before this, but it's something about, I don't have it here. It's in the other one. Some Black Mariah or something like that. It's another Chaykin book. I'll get it. I'll get it after the break or whatever. I think it was before this. That's a little bit different, But I mean, again, it's a nice book. But boy, serious graphic design on that. Like especially like just in general. I mean, Ken Brusenak is involved in it, and
they were a great team, Chaykin and Brusenak.
The coloring is unbelievable. But again, the rendering, I wouldn't say the word is suffers, but it's not the Chaykin that I liked as far as the drawing.
Well, Archie Goodwin wrote that.
Yeah, Archie Goodwin. That's why it's a good story, yeah.
Yeah, Scorpio, he was in the
he was in the original Nick Furies.
Yeah,
right?
the Steranko Nick Furies.
The Nick Furies, yeah.
Yeah, well, two things on this. I remember when this came out.
It was 89.
Howard Chaykin is one of those artists that when I see his work, I grab it. American Flag, to me, is one of the greatest comic series. when Howard Chaykin did it with Ken Brusniak, but later he started bringing in other guys like James Sherman and stuff, it wasn't as good. He was trying to...
Tom Sutton did it.
It wasn't as good as... But the first 12 issues of Howard Chaykin's American Flag are second to none. And there were other issues that Howard Chaykin would step in, and just as beautiful. Since then, he did that four-issue Shadow series for DC. Absolutely great. The Blackhawk Prestige format is 3 issues. I love those. Howard Chaykin was one of those artists that would just come in and just do stuff, and it was, to me, just flabbergasting. And when he started coming back to comic, well, Howard Chaykin kind of, at one point, lost the plot with me a little bit, and this is one reason. When this came out, it was a hardback, and I like Nick Fury, but I just thought it was kind of dumb, Nick Fury and Wolverine. I wasn't interested in reading it. I never bought the book. I looked through it. I don't think it's bad at all, but this isn't the same Howard Chaykin who was doing American Flag. I mean, when I say that, he put the effort in it. It wasn't like when he drew Star Wars and he just kind of not even phoned it in.
No, that's not, it's not phoned in. But it's more graphic design than anything else.
But it is lazier than the works I just mentioned. I mean, he put effort into it, but some of the characters you see, he could have done a little bit differently. He did for DC. I was excited. I was reading about it. It's called Challengers of the Unknown. The old Kirby work. I guess he did a 4-issue series. I think somebody helped him write it. And the advertisements looked really interesting. And the store I went to at the time, he was kind of excited about it. So yeah, I can't wait to get this. The first issue came out, and it was kind of like this. Like he was, I don't know. The story didn't interest me. But basically, from what I remember, the challengers weren't really great heroes in it. It's like they knew how to market themselves and, put in everybody's mind that they were the greatest. And I read the first issue, really wanted to love it, and not hating it, just not interested in buying anymore.
Yeah.
And I've heard Howard Chaykin in interviews talk about he was really proud of that work and really liked the direction, and nobody seemed to care, and he didn't know why. But anytime you take a project, it was something like, it wasn't the Howard Chaykin that I loved. And then all of a sudden it was a big thing. He came back to comics, and I think he did a Wolverine story. And I was excited to hear he was back to drawing instead of just writing. But when I saw the material, I said, I don't want to read that. Well, then he did Avengers 1953, I think it was. I love those. It was a neat story. What they had... Namor's cousin, I think, or those old Atlas characters. There was that blonde Greek lady.
Venus?
Yeah, Venus, I think, was in it. It was fun. And then, Satellite Sam came out, and some of the other stuff, those Century, he did, I think it was the Cowboys.
Yeah.
I love Howard Chaykin, and I love the work he's doing again now, but I don't know. I guess I was kind of tired of the X-Men when this came out, and I was Wolverined out.
Yeah, but, basically. 89, sure.
Yeah, and like I said, though, this isn't the prime Chaykin that, I loved with the other projects I mentioned, but looking at it now, I do like it. And
it's striking.
You said I could read it, and I thought, yeah, I would like to read this. It is striking, but at the same time, it's kind of like how I said John Buscema. I like John Buscema, but after a while, it was just a lot of stock poses and this and that. It wasn't... He got caught for what he's doing.
There's nothing new.
Yeah, he's got tropes, and that's kind of how I see this. It's like he's playing with storytelling, but it didn't seem like he wanted to refine it.
Some of the coloring
is
unbelievable. That's beautiful.
Yeah, and it is neat. In each coloring, you see the colorist was thinking of the scenes. Yeah, it's nice work.
I mean, it really is. He's trying to do like a Toth thing in a way here, but Toth was put a little more draftsmanship into the work. He seems to have been like just really into like just the overall look and design of it. He should have put a little bit more rendering in it, I guess is the word. But then again, if he did that, he would go, well, if I put more rendering in it, it would have taken away from the design, which is what I was going for. So it's a balancing act, but again, I had it for years. I probably never even read it. And I was like, well, let me just read it now. It's a quick read and talk about it on the show. So, yeah, The Scorpio Connection. I think that's the only time it's been printed. I don't know if it's been reprinted or anything.
I've never
like
seen
that.
It again.
Yeah, so there you go.
You know, one thing about Howard Chaykin, I don't think he really likes superheroes at all. And, you know, I guess maybe if it was just two plain clothes people, maybe it would have been a little different. But, I mean, he drew it. He put effort into it. But I don't.
And he was always a design guy, even when you said Star, you know, Cody Starbuck or whatever.
Yeah.
He was always a design guy anyway.
But, you know, my friend Britt always collected Nick Fury sketches. Nick Fury was his favorite character.
Yeah.
And we met Howard Chaykin in 82. He was nothing but just fantastic.
Did he do a Nick Fury sketch
yeah.
for him?
Yeah, and he was very congenial. When Britt asked him, first thing Howard Chaykin said, do you want him in the Nick Fury suit, or would you like him in plain clothes? And then Britt, of course, said, do you have a preference? And Howard Chaykin, yes, I do. And Britt said, just draw it the way you like. And so that's how Howard Chaykin drew him, was basically in a three-piece suit. It's, you know. And you remember that Howard Chaykin he did, for, I think, Marvel premiere or something, did a Nick Fury story, which I loved. And, I mean, it wasn't quite plain clothes all the time. He added the spy element to it. And then Michael Golden came over and saw him drawing that, and he said, you know, I did one of these earlier in the summer, which, again, it was for Brid. And he said, I had so much fun drawing that, because what he drew him in was the spy suit, and he had all these gadgets all over him. You know, Michael Golden just goes for that kind of stuff. And then he looked at Brid and said, oh, I drew it for you. And so, even though Howard Chaykin felt one way, Michael Golden was the opposite. But, I don't know, I guess that's one reason I didn't really want to read this. I was X-Men down. I love the X-Men, but it just...
They're hardly in it. It's more Wolverine. They're in a few panels in there, but that character Arcade is in it, too, for like a...
Who I loved. I guess I would have rather have seen Howard Chaykin do something else than what he was doing there. It didn't seem like he had the interest in doing it, and he just done so many other fantastic things I love that I don't know. It just kind of spoiled it for me. Like I said, there was other things he was drawing later on when he came back to comics. And I was thinking, honestly, that's what you're going to give us. Not that it was bad, but it's just that, you know, he was drawing Wolverine again. And I don't think he really wanted to. And since then, he hasn't, and I've bought all the other stuff. So
there you go. Well, give it a chance.
Yeah. I'll give it a chance, even though it's, what, 30 years later?
Pretty much, yeah. 26 years. God, 26 years.
Yeah, time flies. Anyway, and time flies with us. Let's have a music break.
Dog, no, he didn't treat you kind. You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
And that was the Masons. They're a local band out of Plant City, Florida. They're Ready for Hire, and they are terrific. Anyway, check out the link of our blog. Keep these musicians working.
There you go. All right. So, Times Square, right?
All right. Well, at the break, Al brought in some more Howard Chaykin, because we're not finished with him yet. And this is something Al brought with Times Square. It's a graphic novel he did in 87 for First Comics. And you said something about it, comparing it to the Wolverine.
The Wolverine book, yeah.
Yeah?
This one looks to be a little more, like, it take more time on it.
Yeah.
I guess it's just the way. There's a lot more rendering in it, a lot more design. I mean, it's not totally, you know, different. I mean, it's still the same Howard Chaykin, you know, style or whatever. It's a little more risque, but it seems like he was taking a little more, he put a little more effort into it, probably because it was for, you know, he probably had more of a hand in it. But it's his team, Steve Olef, Kim Brusenak, all those people.
Well, the story of Times Square, Howard Chaykin for First Comics was doing American Flag quite well. But then he started kind of passing it off to other people. And he started developing Times Square. And he talked about it at times. And then I bought an American Flag issue. I kind of went away because I was getting burned buying some of them sometimes. But he came back and did one special issue of American Flag. And it introduced Times Square. And that is one of my single most favorite issues, because American Flag's there, but he ends up in this other world, and the world is kind of like if it was the 40s and all Art Deco, and he was doing all this time shifting kind of stuff, but it was like if the Twilight Zone TV show was doing it. It was, and no kidding, every time I read that, I hear this wild jazz background playing behind it. I mean, it was so good that you could put a soundtrack in your mind. I mean, heavy percussion and horns and stuff. Real Cuban sounding. And I just thought it was the greatest in the world. Well, my wife and I were newly married. We were moving coast to coast. We were broke as a stone. And this was out of the question for me buying. I just didn't have that kind of money. Well, I was talking to a friend of mine who bought it. And I said, yeah, I really want to get that. And he goes, he felt the same way about Howard Chaykin's work. He loved American Flag. And I said, well, I read it in the special. And he goes, he said the story was off. The storytelling was confusing, which I find odd with Howard Chaykin, and this was his baby. He was really putting work into it. And he was trying to be sympathetic about it, but he said, I really wanted to love it. The artwork looks nice. He said, but the story is hard to follow. Really? Well, I never did, was able to purchase it. And I think it was 94. I did. I found it at Wilson's. I didn't go to Wilson's.
94, wow.
Yeah. I went to Wilson's. This is before they had all the books for a dollar. But that back room, it was kind of Spartan. And they had that shelf with all the trades.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they probably had 12 trades on it. And this was one of them. And I went in there and saw it. And I snagged it, jumping up and down, skipping, like finally got it. I'm happy to have it. I mean, our work is second to none. But my friend was correct that the storytelling's hard to follow. The American Flag special he did, it was not hard to follow. It introduced them, and it was terrific. I don't know what failed here, but if you read it, it's like the Vampirella issue we were talking about, how there's like pages missing or something.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And but I don't know. Is this Howard Chaykin's project? He's putting every piece of effort he had into it.
Maybe he put too much into it.
I guess that's it.
Sometimes if you don't get it the first time, you read it a second time. You know, how many records have you listened to for one time and you get, boy, this isn't that great, and then you put it on a couple more times, I get it now, you know?
No, you're absolutely right, and I must say this, if I lost that issue, I would be searching for it again. I mean, I like it. I think it's neat. The artwork, again, is beautiful and second to none. I think it's a neat, unique concept. I like the characters. But it's just when I read the story, it's just not satisfying me.
Hmm.
And it's the only one he ever did of that. And I've heard on those San Diego panels, you know, I kept stressing to people listening to the Howard Chaykin, you know, interview, or he's basically just speaking about his thinking. He's one of those speakers that's really good. He can just get up and talk and, you know, expound what he thinks, and, you know, he doesn't need a foil. But people had asked him about America Flag, if he ever come back to it. And he says, well, he explained that the reason he did America Flag was he was angry about the Reagan administration and, you know, that whole environment. And he said, that would be hard for him to go back to. You know, I was a young man and a young man's thinking. And when somebody mentioned he's done Black Kiss again, they went back to that. He said, well, it's a different thing. He's still interested in that kind of stuff and, you know, the storyline of that. I've never heard anybody mention Times Square. I've never heard him mention it again.
Was that the only graphic novel he did of it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It was just this. It was just this and the American Flag special.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, nevertheless, it's still Howard Chaykin, and it's prime Howard Chaykin. And if you have any interest in Howard Chaykin, then I recommend picking it up.
Yeah, I mean, back then it was, how much was it? So it was $8. Yeah, that is a lot for 87. Again, eight comic books,
yeah.
You know, or at least six. Six, maybe, you know, I don't know, for that. And look at the cover, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. I love the characters. The only thing is, I'm going to say this, I love this character. Don't you see an evil Clark Kent?
Yeah, I always see a little bit of Howard Chaykin, too.
Yeah.
With the big glasses.
But when I see Howard Chaykin, I see a strong man, but I don't see him as evil. I see him as, just don't be a jerk to him, you know, because he'll cut you down to size. But this guy, he looks sinister. And every time I see him, I think of Clark Kent, but like if Lex Luthor possessed Clark Kent and he was evil.
I also see like a heavier Elvis Costello in
yeah.
there, too. Heavier,
yeah. But, yeah, it's like Elvis Costello if he was back in the 40s.
Yeah, yeah. Waiting a little more, but anyway, yeah. I just grabbed that because it was like the same era as the Wolverine Nick Fury, but I think the artwork was a little better on that one, so.
All right, I'm bringing one to the table. This is one I've already talked about, but I want to talk about it again.
Black Widow.
Black Widow by Mark Waid, Chris Samnee. And this is issue number 6. It's a great series. From what I understood, and I don't know if this is still the case, Mark Waid and Chris Samnee were a great team. But I think when Black Widow started, I was thinking that Chris Samnee was basically writing it with Mark Waid's assistant. And it just read fantastic. I'm not sure if that's changed and Mark Waid is actually writing the whole thing out. But like I say, she's an enemy of S.H.I.E.L.D. now. She's getting away, but they're kind of telling more of her story. And they start telling her story how she started out in Russia and became a spy, which I found really interesting. And she's kind of an indifferent character in this in some ways. That spread right there, that's worth the price of admission right there. Iron Man found out that, I guess they retrofitted the Iron Man movie into the comic books, because in the movie he's in a cave, you know, in Afghanistan. And this doctor is there, and he saves Tony Stark, convinced him to build that weapon to save him, and then he dies. And in this one, there's a professor that helps him. I think I don't know where he's from. But anyway, he finds out it's because of the Black Widow that he died. And he was the reason Tony Stark was saved in that cave. And so Tony Stark goes after her. But that two-page spread of Iron Man flying across the city, worth the price. Anyway, but it goes on, and she's still super awesome, super secret.
His work seems to be taking more, also speaking of Chaykin, is tending to take more of a design look to it, if that's possible. There's a lot of blacks in there, there's a lot of renderings, a lot of graphic stuff in there, you know, as opposed to, which is fine, which I like a lot, you know, but definitely a little bit different from the Daredevil stuff, but, I mean, that's just a progression of the artist or, you know.
Yeah, he does have a design. He reminds me of Steranko a lot, too.
Yeah, a little bit of Toth. A little bit of Toth in some panels and stuff like that. On the cover, yeah, definitely Steranko. So what's next?
Well, you brought something up.
Yeah, I just brought it out because we were just talking, and I put it to the other side from, wow, this is from like 89. Again, wow, 89. We're hitting the early 90s, late 80s hard or whatever. This is The Art of Walt Simonson, published by DC, which I guess is where he was doing most of his work. Is this before? No, this is after Thor, isn't
it? Oh, yeah.
It?
Thor finished up, and, well, he stopped drawing Thor in 86, early 86. And he wrote it, and Sal Buscema drew it. And I think I think he finished all that by then. And I think he did Fantastic Four for a little bit in 88. And I think 89, I don't know what he was doing.
Yeah, some of the stuff I remember. I remember Manhunter. I remember Captain Fear. Yeah. I remember Dr. Fate. I do not remember, what is this called? UFM Return. I do not remember this job.
Wasn't that from Star Spangled War?
Don't know.
Oh, open the next page.
I don't know. It looks like a sci-fi book. It doesn't look like a war.
Oh, no, I don't remember that one either.
I don't remember this either. Hercules, yeah, but it's funny because, okay, they printed the one where he, you know, inked it, because a lot of these were inked by, some were inked by Wally Wood, and you could never tell.
Yeah.
It was Walt Simonson, but they put out the one that where he inked it himself, so of course it looks like Walt Simonson. But Wally Wood just was like, hey, that's great. The Metal Men, I remember getting those back in the 70s. Those were great. A lot of the Metal Men. I think he did some. What was this? More Metal Men. I guess is the rest of this Metal Men. Yeah, looks like it. Yep. I guess this is just a DC work, but he did a lot more Manhunter, correctly.
The Manhunter they put out in the special. That's a Batman story.
The Manhunter was in a special. Okay, yeah. This is just a Batman story. I remember this one, too.
What they were doing is kind of like that Darwin Cook graphic ink book we talked about last time. You know, Walt Simonson, he was an artist I liked. I bought a lot of these issues that he had done in the past. And then he did that X-Men Teen Titans crossover, which he kind of went away from comics for a while. All of a sudden he did that. And then they announced he was going to do Thor. And then he put out that Star Slammers graphic novel, which I think
is... Star Slammers. Yeah. Then he did the Aliens... Well, the Aliens movie adaptation was earlier, though.
Yeah, he did that for Heavy Metal.
That was in the late 70s or early 80s or something.
Very early 80s.
Was it the Alien movie, the first one?
Yeah.
So it was in the 70s.
I've got that.
Yeah, that's
and
a good one.
He was saying that when he did that, it says 20th Century Fox sent him all kinds of references. He said, you know, I've never worked with anybody that was so helpful at making sure he had all the references he needed. So, and he was kind of proud of the fact that he put a comic book on the New York Times bestseller list because it was popular. I think Heavy Metal put that one out originally. But
I remember doing a Close Encounters adaptation for Marvel.
Yeah, he did.
Inked by Klaus Janson.
But he did stuff like that. But then all of a sudden, he did, like I said, he did the Teen Titans X-Men crossover. That was extremely popular. And he was announced to do Thor, and then he put out that Star Slammers graphic novel, which to me is second to none. That's one of my favorite things, and I was really hoping he was going to keep going on with that. Then he did Thor, which was one of my favorite runs of comics. And then after that, he jumped around. He did some X-Factor work with his wife and planned out the whole X-Men line thing with his wife and and Chris Claremont. I never really read those. And he did some Fantastic Four issues, which were really unique and imaginative.
Yeah, those were fun, yeah. I like those, yeah.
And somebody had said one time, they think by this time, Walt Simonson, this is in the end of the 80s, that he is looking at himself as an idea man. And that was absolutely, he was one of those that was just unique. But anyway, at that time, I think it was in 84, DC Comics put out a really thick collection, or, you know, comic book collection of all the Manhunter stories he did, which was a backup in Detective Comics. And then the last story was Manhunter, it was the full story with him and Batman, a full issue-length story. And I bought it because I just love Walt Simonson. And again, I read the story and thought, this is one of the greatest stories I think I've ever read. Anyway, they put this out, The Art of Walter Simonson, and it was a collection of his DC stories. But I don't know, the cover really turned me off. I mean, it's basically four separate sketches. One's of Batman, one's of Ten from the Metal Men, one of Dr. Fate, and one of Captain Fear. And at the top of the book, they made it look like it was a spiral, you know, sketchbook.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
And I thought it was just a sketchbook. I never bought it. I didn't like the cover. I love Walt Simonson. Don't get me wrong. He's one of those that if I see him, I buy it. But I did not. And the DC logo, they have masking tape on it. It's like they're trying to make it look like an art. Well, I'm
like an art book, like a sketchbook.
I'm in the field. I see this every day. It was nothing thrilling to me. Well, anyway, I've never opened it.
Wow.
Al brought it in, and this is the first thing I ever looked into. Oh, it's stories. And basically, it's all the DC work that I'd seen some of it. I had the Dr. Fate first issue special, and that is nice. Especially that page.
Mm.
With Anubis. But, anyway, it has his Captain Fear stories. You know, Star Spangled War story he did, and the Metal Men stories. I had three of those issues. I didn't have all of them. He's just a unique, imaginative artist, and fluid work. Anyway, just fun, unique.
There you go.
Anyway, I told Al, now I'm kind of wishing I would have bought it. And you mentioned there's all kinds of online sellers. I am going to find this.
Yeah, now. You can find it.
So anyway.
It probably won't be that much, I don't think.
But it should be.
Okay. So what's next?
All right. I'm going to just bring up one book. I found this in the dollar box.
Bob's Burgers.
Bob's Burgers. Bob's Burgers is a show on Fox on Sunday nights. And it's a cartoon I really like. It's a guy with, it's his family, and he has...
Is it by the Simpsons people?
No. But it's a burger place. The guy has a restaurant. He's got three kids and a wife, and they're a sideways family. Anyway, I didn't think I liked the show, and I ended up loving it. What surprised me, the guy that created the show also did the theme music to it. He starts out with a ukulele, and... there's a fantastic podcast called Song Exploder, and basically every episode they have an artist. I mean, these are, you know, prime recording artists now, current ones, and any kind of artist, rock, blues, hip-hop, you know, R&B singers, but they have one song, and they basically talk about where they came up with it, and they break down each sound and where they came up with it, like a guitar part or a beat. And how they built around it and how they recorded it. And then when the episode finishes, they play the whole thing. And I just thought, hey, what a great show. Anyway, they had the guy from Bob's Burgers.
Oh, wow.
And he is talking about, you know, he always plays the ukuleles. And he collects a lot of junk instruments in his office. And he did say, now this is something, if I had a cartoon show on, which would be awesome, I couldn't do the theme song because I have no musical ability. I have an appreciation and that's it. But he starts talking about, he had this kind of idea for, you know, a ukulele piece, and then how he started adding drums and all the other stuff, and then he had his drum track, but then he hired a professional drummer to play it, and he kept both of them, because he's talking about a professionalism and an everyday, everyday ineptitude that people go through. And it was a great episode. Anyway, I bought this in the dollar box. I liked the cartoon. I got for free comic day 2 years ago a Bob's Burger comic, and I liked it. And even though it's got a style of the cartoon, each creator that did a story in it did it their own way, you know. So it was kind of like looking at an issue of Creepy or Eerie when they had different artists. Anyway, I saw this. It's from Dynamite. I'll pick it up. This is great fun. It, they put a lot into it. The first story is talking about the oldest daughter. The first story is written by Brian Hall, and the artist is Frank Forte. And it looks like it's colored in Photoshop, and some of it looks like they actually used photographs for the background. But they go sideways on it because in this one, there's a kid that's been in the episodes that's kind of smart. He's like a gadget geek. In this one, out of cardboard, he builds a duplicating machine. The eldest daughter gets into it. She duplicates it herself because the guy she likes is trying to put together a dance group. And nobody will do it, and he's falling apart. So she duplicates herself, and she's his dance team. They do really well. But now he's dating, how many? There's like 12 of them. And it's got stuff like fantasy food truck concept art, and it's like an Arctic fantasy food truck. It just goes on and on and on. It's talking about one episode they had, there was cockroaches in the basement, and they spelled out high. Anyway, this one, they go down the basement, they break a hole through the wall, and there's all these tunnels. Well, the mortician works next door, and he saw them, and he said that they had they built the tunnels to connect all the buildings when it snowed too much, wherever they're at. And he said that's how they worked it. Anyway, all this nonsense goes on at the very end. The cockroach was there, and they spelled out the end. It's got a full moon lounge Gene. Gene's the middle kid. What does that look like?
It looks like, is it that Kaluta story or something like that?
Well, this is, when I first see it, I see two things. The first thing I saw was Little Nemo in Slumberland.
Yeah.
Because of the bed. And
there
it's
was
all
a Kaluta story about the girl in her bedroom, that something like that.
Yeah, there was. There was. You're absolutely right. Yeah. But this first thing I see is the wild things. Where the wild things are.
Yeah.
But I also
Maurice
see
Sendak,
yeah, who was the man. You know, talking about Howard Chaykin's Times Square, I could see that really awesome jazz soundtrack in the back. When I was 7 years old, I checked that book, Where the Wild Things Are, out of the library. And as soon as I opened that book, I could hear tom-tom drums in the background just constantly going through. And to this day, whenever I see that book or any illustration here, boom, 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 boom.
Wow.
That's the power of a great story, you know. But anyway, it's kind of a poetic, like I said, like the wild things. And but it has the story where the son turns into a lounge singer. And he goes out and is doing well. His parents realize that they lost their son. And he's got all these people cheering him. And then he thinks about his family. And then the whole thing finishes. It says, soon Gene looked more Gene-ish. His youth is recouped. And he rushed to his true home in time to go poop. And it ends with him sitting on the toilet. Much like Where the Wild Things, he came back home and his food was still warm. I don't know, just great, great fun. It's got a lot of spot illustrations. The actual cover price in this is $3.99, and I don't know if I would have enjoyed it as much if I would have paid $4 for it. But if you can find the dollar box like I did, then I'll tell you, second to none. And part of the reason I brought this up is because, you know, growing up, you'd buy the Dell comics are actually pretty nice. But Gold Key comics, they'd have, like, based on a TV show or a movie you liked. And when I was growing up, they were pretty bad. I remember buying some Mighty Mouse and Battle of the Planets from Gold Key. And they were fifth-rate at best.
I don't know, man. If I say, I got to find out, because I remember seeing the covers for Battle of the Planets. Because I don't know if he did the insides or not, but I know they were done by Win Mortimer, and I liked his work a lot, so I'll have to double check on that. Oh, Dynamite's doing the Spirit, huh? Look at that.
Yeah.
Did they already? I don't know.
What's the indicia say on this book? I think this is recent.
I think if it's Battle of the Planets, I like Win Mortimer's artwork a lot, but this is 2014, man.
Yeah. Win Mortimer, he was the one that did those Spidey Super Stories, right?
Yeah, but that's not his best work. He did a lot. He did Legion of Superheroes, did a lot of romance books, or whatever, but he did do the Spidey Super Stories.
I love him. I mean, as soon as you said Legion, I remember
this
those
from 2014.
Stories.
2014. I don't remember seeing this.
I don't either.
All
right. Yeah, I don't either. I was surprised at that. But,
a lot of stuff we missed.
But that Spirit cover looks really good. I guess that's when DC stopped doing it.
Yeah, the Darwin Cook ones.
I find that strange that some of these companies are licensing out big companies' work. Like, and I say that I love them, but IDW, when they were putting out the best of Don DeCarlo and best of Sam Swartz for Archie, but it's IDW. And IDW was taking other properties from Marvel and DC and Archie, all these big publishers. I don't know. A lot of times, I had read that, what was that writer? I can't think of his name now. But he was writing for The Simpsons. And one thing he said was that, he said the same thing I did, that a lot of these adaptations people used to do for cartoons we liked. I remember Goldkey had Woody Woodpecker stories. I bought them. I read them. But they didn't seem anything like the Woody Woodpecker cartoon. And you get Bugs Bunny or the Pink Panther, and it was always the same story. The character that you know well doesn't act anything like he does on TV. He walks by, sees something, talks to the people, and then there's kind of an odd ending, you know, thing that happens at the end. But basically, the only thing that changed was just the actual cartoon character himself. And anyway, he was saying, Dan Slott, that's who brought it up. He wrote Ren and Stimpy, and he's writing The Simpsons. He said, you know, when we were kids, you'd read these, and they were so bad. He said, the reason why, these guys weren't even familiar with the cartoon character itself. He said, what the writers would do was they just have generic stories that they had written, and then when they said, oh, I've got a Pink Panther story, all right, and they just dust off one of these and just change the name to Pink Panther and put them out. And he was basically saying what you have to do is immerse yourself into the world. And so, you know, it's different now because you can sit there, pull out, you know, DVDs and watch all the episodes of The Simpsons or watch them on Netflix or whatever. And same thing with Bob's Burgers. But I tell you, I pick up a lot of these books once in a while, especially on Free Comic Day. I'll pick out something and check them. And it feels like the shows or the video games now, you know, whenever I read some of these comic adaptations. It wasn't so in the past, anyway. But now you got me interested. The Battle of the Planets I got, and I still have that issue.
I think he did them. I know he did. I know he was looking at an advertisement the other day, and he drew the advertisement for the Battle of the Planets.
Yeah.
I'm thinking he drew the interior, so I don't own any of them. So.
Well, the cover.
The picture I saw, they were all standing, and they're all like doing like almost like a this kind of, you know, salute or whatever.
Yeah.
All eight or nine. It was one more, and I go, oh, that's kind of cool. I like that.
Well, the one I got, it's not that cover. And the cover, a lot of Goldkey's, the covers were pretty good. You know, I mean, they were sometimes simple, but they caught me. The interior was just through the motions. I'll dig it up.
It's possible. It was him, and he was just cranking it out. You know, he did a lot of work for Goldkey. A lot of it was in the supernatural books or whatever, you know. But I always thought that he had a nice kind of loose, sketchy, but you know, right on style. But you know,
he mentioned that
he did do the Legion, some Legion.
Yeah,
in the
60s. And I absolutely love the Legion, and I do know there were times where the artist would change some. I loved them all, but I remember his Legion stories. He had a. When I say this, I look back on him with great fondness. And I always bought, even though I was too old, I bought the Spidey Super Stories, you know. And those weren't always on par with, say, like the regular Spider-Man book.
They were more for kids.
They were written for kids, but for some reason I enjoyed...
I did enjoy them, too.
And my brother bought them, so I read a lot of those later.
Yeah, one I put in your Dropbox, the one with the cat or whatever.
Yeah. One of my favorite episodes that Alan and I did was when we talked about the whole story of the cat and Tigra and then the Hellcat. And we mentioned everything we could think of, but you found that Spidey Super Stories that you've forgotten.
Yeah.
I had them all because back then, if Spider-Man was in it, I was going to buy it. I love Spider-Man.
Cool.
And Spidey Super Stories came out. I thought it was odd. It was Electric Company, but I bought it anyway.
Yeah.
And I still have one. It was the issue with Medusa from the Inhumans. I just always liked it. Usually that book had three stories in it, and they were written for smaller children. It was written simply, but...
It was drawn simpler, too.
Yeah. But Win Mortimer, he always had an honest style to me.
Yeah, right? It was Win Mortimer inked by Mike Esposito.
Yeah,
so
I love Mike Esposito.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the work was simple, but Win Mortimer, he was solid. And he didn't put on any airs, but I don't know, there was something about it that I just always kind of liked. But do you know anything about his background?
Oh, God, he was around in the 40s. I mean, I think he even drew old Supermans, too, like in the 40s or maybe early 50s. As far as I know, he kept working on through comics, doing, like, you know, a lot of romance books, superhero books. I think he probably worked in advertising, too. I can't, I'm not 100% sure, but it looks like his style became more advertising looking. But I think he's mostly known for his romance stuff. But yeah, he did a lot of work for Gold Key, Whitman, whatever they were called, and a lot of it was Ripley, Boris Karloff, and stuff like that. But I always liked his work. I always thought it was like simple, but it was like honest, like you said, and it was like drawn like. It was almost drawn very fluid-like. Like, it was like, okay, here's how I draw and here's how I ink it. Just exactly. I'm not going to give you any errors. I'm not going to give you anything you don't need to know. Here's boom, 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 done. You know, very, I don't know if the word's artistic, but it looks like very illustrative, you know. Simple, though. But, yeah, I always loved his work.
I did, too. He had a control over his work. But sometimes, like Gil Kane's example, Gil Kane was a solid artist. But as he went on, he started developing a more of a style. And you can say the same about Howard Chaykin. The style developed into something I loved and you didn't like as much. Wynn Mortimer, he never really seemed to worry so much about style. He was worrying more about substance.
The storytelling.
Yeah, the storytelling. I mean, like I said, his drawings were solid, but he never really refined them to... Well, I keep thinking about it as a 70s type artist.
He never really changed his style to fit modern tropes or whatever. It was always Wynn Mortimer. You know, maybe in the 60s he maybe got a little more, he started drawing a little more, putting a little more detail in, but it was like, I'm not going to draw like, now it's the 70s, I'm not going to start drawing like George Perez or John Byrne. I'm going to change. It's Wynn Mortimer, take it or leave it, you know, which is what a lot of the old guys were kind of, you know. I mean, it's like Jack Kirby never really changed his style that much. He just refined it as the years went on. Or Joe Sinnott refined it a lot, too, you know. But, yeah.
Well, this comic store I went to in the 70s, I remember I was talking to the man. Because, you know, I was 17, I think. And this man was quite a bit older. But he just brought up something that I'd always been on the cusp of when he said, I said, yeah, you're right. He said, if you look at Jack Kirby's Golden Age work, and then you look at his 70s work, you know, 60s and 70s, it looks like two completely different artists.
Pretty much.
And you can tell, though. Yeah. Well, one thing you brought up was you think Joe Simon had a lot to do with that.
Had a lot to do with the inking, yeah.
And Jack Kirby had a way, and then the inking kind of changed it. But all of a sudden, as he progressed on, he always had a kind of carved look to everything. But all of a sudden, his work he started doing in the 60s was... solid granite. You know, before it always could be like wood or something. You know, it was just thin and solid but wispy, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
But yeah, he did develop into something completely different that I ate up with
everything. Everybody did, yeah. So
anyway, well, it's been about time. I don't want to stop talking, but I got to.
But we have to. we'll do some more soon.
Anyway, listen, whoever you are in the Russian Federation, you're still downloading this to, like, no tomorrow. I'd like to hear from you, unless you're a robot. And if you are, why are you downloading this?
Yeah, really.
Anyway.
We haven't done a Magnus Robot Fighter show yet, but we will, in case you're a robot.
Anyway, I guess that's all about. Thanks for listening. If you get a chance, feel free to leave us an iTunes review. It really helps us out a lot. It only takes a second. And in the meantime,
read more comics.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A-Go-Go, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops!